Welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest is Adam Brock, a permaculture teacher and practitioner from the Grow House in Colorado, who is also developing an invisible structures pattern language. You can find out more about the latter project by going to Adam's personal site, peoplepattern.org, or by following the link in the show notes. Adam sat down with me to talk about the international permaculture convergence that occurred in Cuba, as well as the Permaculture Voices Conference. But we begin this interview by touching on his pattern language before moving on to those other topics. The conversation represents his personal experiences at both of these events and also provides feedback on how we can use what he learned there to continue to improve our work as professionals to make our community more inclusive and productive for the people who need and want it. We also touch on how permaculture is continuing to expand at a rapid pace and about some of the movements to codify the PDC process and vet various professionals in the field. There was a time when a few phone calls could help us get a personal understanding of a particular teacher or project, but that is getting harder and harder as the sheer number of practitioners and people offering classes and workshops continue to grow. If you enjoy this conversation, or any of those that are available in the archives, which currently includes every episode of the show, consider becoming a one-time or ongoing monthly supporter of the podcast. You can find out how by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to Adam Brock. I'll join you again afterwards with some thoughts and a class announcement. Then, Adam, you've been with us before, and I will include a link in the show notes back to our earlier interviews for people who are interested in learning more about your background and biography. If you'd like to begin with a little bit of an update of where things have gone since those times, with the current work that you're doing, your expansion of your pattern language, and then we can talk about the IPC in Cuba, as well as the Permaculture Voices Conference and what you learned from those experiences.
Yeah, sounds great, Scott. The last, the last 8 months or so have been pretty exciting for me in my own development as a permaculturalist. I think, like you mentioned, it was a really great experience for me to attend the International Permaculture Convergence in Cuba at the end of November, beginning of December, and really just, you know, kind of expose me to the real international community of people in this movement, who many of whom have been doing this for decades. And I think it really helped give me a context for the work I'm doing locally in Colorado to understand how it fits into that broader movement. Obviously, I'd had interactions with other permaculturalists around the country, but to get that international perspective and to see everybody in one place and to see the, you know, the different areas where folks were in agreement about where the movement is going and where it should go, and also the places where there's still some questions, really helped me get a much deeper and richer understanding of that. Not to mention, of course, being in Cuba and having that really amazing case study to learn from. So that was a very catalytic experience, so to speak. And then I came back from Cuba and have been really active here in Denver and helping launch a local permaculture guild, kind of taking our organizing to the next level and continuing to experiment with new invisible structures. And then kind of along those same lines, I've been really kind of putting a lot of work into the invisible structures pattern language that we discussed the last time I was chatting with you. And so that's really starting to crystallize for me. I've developed a blog that I'll be sharing more and more of those patterns on. And I'm also contemplating a book proposal to develop that into essentially a book of social permaculture patterns.
Is the blog currently up and running and something that listeners can go visit now to learn more about this?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I just recently launched the blog. It's called People and Pattern. The URL is peoplepattern.org. And by the time this goes live, there should be quite a few of my patterns on there as blog posts. I'm planning on posting a new pattern or two every week or so. A colleague of mine, Holly White, is doing some original art for it that's been really beautiful so far. So you can go on there, peoplepattern.org, and browse the different patterns by subject, whether you're interested in, you know, invisible structures like social justice or economics or self-care. You can kind of break it down in those ways. And then there's a big master list of all the patterns, so you can see how all of these patterns are interconnected even before I've posted the entire blog post about each one.
Really gives people a chance to work through this material with you as you continue to develop it, provide feedback, and help you expand on these ideas as you proceed?
That's exactly the idea. Yeah, I'd certainly like to turn this into a conversation as I work out these patterns for myself, and to get the input and feedback from other folks that have different angles on this material. And then, you know, as I mentioned, as I'm writing this, part of the long-term vision is to start to consolidate it into something that might be published in the future. Another kind of goal of mine as I assemble these patterns is to start to lead social permaculture workshops and intensives. There's a few social permaculture courses being offered, one or two in the States, and I know there's one in the UK, but I think that's a real area of growth for our kind of professional education. As we've discussed, the PDC mostly focuses on the physical structures and is a very really important and set curriculum. But I think a lot of folks that I've worked with have mentioned that they would love more training in that invisible structures realm. So kind of structuring courses around these patterns that I'm developing is another kind of parallel track.
That's a conversation that was brought up in my PDC going on 4 years ago now, that you could offer a PDC that is permaculture for business, permaculture for artists, but that for so long we've spent all these years using the garden as the metaphor, that's the place where the education has gone. And now there are lots of opportunities as this kind of, if you will, third or fourth wave of permaculture practitioners come along to take that big umbrella that Mollison and Holmgren first provided us with and really begin to expand on that information.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, I think that speaks to the other kind of experience that I had in the last several months, which was I had the opportunity to take a road trip to California in March and attend, as well as speak at the Permaculture Voices Conference, which happened just outside of San Diego the beginning of March. And that was a really eye-opening experience as well, and a very interesting kind of contrast with the IPC in Cuba. You know, the Voices Conference was a deliberate attempt to really, so to speak, professionalize permaculture as a movement and present it in a way that's much more accessible to folks who don't own farms or who don't come from kind of a fringe alternative background. It was, you know, held in a conference center. It was very slickly and well produced. All the logistics were very well handled, which, you know, for better or worse, you don't always see at permaculture gatherings. So, you know, that was a very interesting experience for me to see what does permaculture look like outside of this movement that we're used to thinking of permaculture of having. And as it starts to reach more and more of a broad audience, how can it adapt itself to different ways of existing in the world without losing its essence and integrity? So, you know, it was interesting for me at that conference. I was very excited by a lot of the ways I saw that happening. And then there were some ways in which I was a little put off or nervous about ways in which I saw permaculture being discussed and values that it seems like it was leaving behind, or groups of people that it was leaving behind as well. So I think this will continue to be an ongoing conversation. You know, I think as permaculture gets larger, obviously it has a lot more opportunities to affect populations that it hasn't before. And I think there also continue to be tensions and deliberation within the permaculture movement about how we're going about what we're doing and what is our best approach to scale.
I actually just spoke with Diego this morning before we sat down to record this interview. So,
well, that's timely. Yeah, and he and I had a lengthy conversation after the conference as well. And, you know, it was all good. I think he understands a lot of the challenges with what he's trying to do. And he's very open to feedback, and I think received a lot of feedback after the conference from myself and many other people that he's incorporating, as any permaculturist does, you know, incorporate that feedback and do it better the next time. So I really look forward to seeing how Permaculture Voices version 2.0 plays out next year.
I wish I could get this term that he used properly, but I believe it was something like, it was collaboration plus competition.
Mm.
I don't exactly remember the way that he contracted the two together, but that's a way within the permaculture community for us to continue to proceed, that we can cooperate with one another in order to build what it is we're doing, but a little bit of healthy competition as we develop our own place, if you will, within the movement, as we find the space for ourselves that we can grow and succeed in the best.
Yeah, very much so. I think there's certainly nothing wrong with a little bit of competition, as long as it's, you know, intentional and structured in the right way, like any of our other structures.
Because it was the piece that occurred first, I was wondering if we could step back to discuss your experiences at the IPC in Cuba.
Yeah.
And then take that, and then we'll, I guess, if you will, compare and contrast that with your experience at the Permaculture Voices conference several months later. My first question as an American is, I'm always a little bit confused about the travel to Cuba from the US and the embargoes, and there is no embargo and all these other pieces about getting there. Did you have any problems traveling to Cuba for the IPC?
Fortunately not. It is a little bit confusing, but essentially the way the law is currently set up, and of course this is changing all the time, but you know, as of the end of 2013, it is legal for a U.S. citizen to travel to Cuba as long as they can prove that they're going for something related to their own professional development or education, or something that is related to their business, and there's a conference there. And in this case, it was both of those things. So the trip was organized by a third-party travel provider that runs trips for Americans to Cuba on a regular basis. They're called Global Exchange. They're based out of the Bay Area, and they just did a tremendous job helping us basically take care of all of our accommodations, from, you know, the visa to the hotel to arranging transportation and things like that. There were some Americans that went without Global Exchange and did it on their own or with other providers. So that certainly wasn't the only way to do it. But I had a fantastic experience going through them and had no hassles going through customs or anything like that.
Once you made it on the ground to Cuba and the IPC, what was the overall experience like for you?
It was really fascinating. Obviously, being in Cuba itself is such an exciting opportunity. And I know that many permaculturalists are familiar with the movie The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil, which has really created a very kind of strong narrative in the permaculture world about this is what a society could look like after peak oil. This is what could happen if we all get together and reclaim our land and really take urban agriculture and organic agriculture seriously. And that movie was made about 10 years ago, which was 10 years after the so-called special period, when Cubans lost most of their imports and exports with the Soviet Union. And in the time since, you know, it's been interesting to see how things have continued to shift for Cubans. I think in some ways, what you're starting to see is a shift back towards kind of the more capitalist, import-export-driven, large-scale agriculture model. You know, what we saw was that, yes, Cubans are still growing 80% of the produce in Cuba that they consume. But on the other hand, not all of the food we eat is produce, right? And actually 80% of the food they eat is imported. And a lot of that is rice and meat, which could come from anywhere that Americans eat those things as well. It seems like, you know, on one hand, there was still a very strong interest in local food production and local agriculture. But permaculture in particular wasn't really the household word that you might get the picture that it was after seeing The Power of Community. It still is, even, you know, among proponents of organic agriculture in Cuba, still, you know, at the fringes of the discourse, as it is anywhere else. And it has its place, and there's a lot of high-ranking officials that respect it, but it's certainly not the only game in town. And there is a lot of industrial agriculture happening in Cuba as well. So that was interesting to see, just how the permaculture narrative is playing out in this space. And then, you know, it was just interesting to see in general, in a place like Cuba, you know, I've been to lots of places around the world. I've spent a lot of time in India, I've traveled in Brazil and Europe. But until going to Cuba, I realized I'd never been in a non-capitalist economy. And I had no idea before going what was going to be different and what wasn't. You know, I just taken for granted that everywhere you go, there's advertisements, there's private enterprise, people with storefronts on the street. And I wasn't sure which of these things I was going to see and which ones I wasn't. and how that would work on the scale of a national economy. So it was interesting to get on the ground and see that, yes, there were no advertisements. And that was wonderful, you know, to be in a society where you weren't bombarded with this barrage of corporations asking you to buy something. And instead of billboards, there was a healthy dose of public art, or, you know, if you want to call it propaganda that was sponsored by the government, a lot of it pro-communist, anti-imperialist, anti-USA, lots of murals of Che Guevara and things like that. Some of it really, really actually beautiful, aesthetically amazing art. And some of it did very much kind of just seem like propaganda. But either way, it was great to see that instead of advertisements. And then the kind of communist economy is starting to hybridize with capitalism. Up until very recently, there were no, for example, private restaurants on the streets of Havana. But now there's more and more of those things. And while it certainly doesn't have the feel of a tourist community or anything like that, more and more folks are starting to embrace their own, you know, entrepreneurial initiative. So it's interesting to see that just kind of re-sprouting, but still with very much of an awareness of the dangers of getting too big or of big business and corporate takeover. So that was interesting to me, and also to see the ways in which a kind of command and control economy like Cuba's has results in a society that I would say is probably just as dysfunctional as ours. It's just dysfunctional in different ways. I think there's often a tendency, especially among people interested in new ways of organizing society, to idealize Cuba and to say, look, these are folks that have actually made it work, whatever it is in their heads. And it's true that it is one of the only places in the world that stood up to the kind of growing tide of global corporatism, and they've been able to hold that at bay. But that doesn't make it a utopia by any means. You know, there's still very much divisions of class. There are people who are more wealthy than others by any standards. And then, you know, I think that kind of top-down economic planning results in these very large bureaucracies that make things that we take for granted that are serviced by the free market very easily and cheaply and quickly make them a big hassle. You know, so elevators are broken all the time. You have to wait in line for things that we would never think of waiting in line for. You know, just these little things like that, that capitalism just kind of takes care of, you realize in a kind of planned economy, don't always flow so smoothly. So, you know, just a lot of little insights like that I found really helpful for my own understanding of how do we organize society in a way differently than the one we're all used to.
I thank you for sharing that rather balanced approach to viewing that economy. What you spoke to about, you know, idealizing in some ways certain things, it's very easy to do, or to be biased towards the positive and not the negatives, and to understand that any system is dysfunctional in some way, but that we can work on removing some of that dysfunction through the models that we have available to us and through planning and design and experimenting with different things.
Yeah, I mean, I think this stuff it's always going to be a continuous work in progress. We're always figuring this stuff out as we go. But, you know, I think Cuba is very, very valuable just as an example of a different kind of dysfunction. You know, I think if all we see is the dysfunction of capitalism, then, yeah, of course, we're going to want to erase all of that and go totally in the other direction. And Cuba shows us how the pendulum can swing too far in another direction as well, and where we might need to look for balances in that. And then for me personally, I feel like a lot of this comes down to scale. You know, anytime you're trying to design an economy or any kind of social system that is beyond a human scale, I think you're going to result in inefficiencies, you're going to result in challenges of inequality. And so I think, to me, just seeing Cuba as a society of several million people struggle with the same issues, just approaching it from a different dimension, was just kind of confirmation of that sense for myself.
With all your work on invisible structures, or as Dave Jackie would call them, the social and economic structures of permaculture, it sounds like your trip to Cuba was very informative for your perspective in designing different principles and patterns for those structures.
it definitely added a lot of fuel to the fire, so to speak. Definitely being in Cuba, and then obviously the whole other really amazing part of the trip was just being in the company of so many folks who are, you know, kind of heroes in the permaculture world. To just, you know, be able to be standing in the lunch line, you know, one of those many lines that I mentioned, but right behind Albert Bates, and just be making small talk with him, and then be at a little breakout session the next day with 20 people, one of whom is Starhawk. And, you know, to just be able to sit side by side with these folks, hear their perspective, and really take in, not in a kind of polished or remote way, but in a very kind of human to human way, the work that they've been doing, I think that was really inspiring and empowering for me as well. And just kind of a lot of little lessons just sunk in there.
I had a note here to ask you who you encountered and who the highlights were from your experience. You mentioned Albert Bates and Starhawk. I hate to use this term, but it's what's sitting in my brain at the moment. Who else among the permaculture rock stars did you encounter while you were there?
Well, let's see. It was actually really eye-opening for me to get to know a little bit of the permaculture scene in other countries, like I'd mentioned. You know, there was a pretty large Australian delegation. So, you know, Darren Doherty gave a keynote talk, Robin Francis, Robin Clayfield, all of these folks whose names I'd heard and read many times, but finally getting the chance to put a face with the name and to really understand what their niche is within the permaculture movement in Australia and internationally. That was really powerful. As well as several British folks. Andy Goldring, who helps run the Permaculture Association UK, gave a keynote talk one of the first days of the conference. And again, from an invisible's perspective, was very inspiring to me to see how in the UK they have a very strong national infrastructure for supporting permaculturalists that, from what I can tell, doesn't feel too much like a top-down telling people what to do, but is really just there to support people on a national scale with this whole network of demonstration sites and a recognized diploma program and, you know, all kinds of things like that. And to see how they formed that and organized it and how it's evolved over time, that was really neat to see as well. I'd also like to add that, you know, some of the people I were most inspired by were not the so-called rock stars. You know, they're, you know, folks who have either just quietly been doing this work under the radar for 15, 20 years or people in that so-called third wave, who have, just like myself, you know, maybe took their PDC 5, 6, 7 years ago and are just starting to really do some powerful work in their own communities and taking permaculture in new places. One of the things I was really inspired and encouraged by about the conference was to see that I was far from the only voice talking about the intersection of permaculture and social justice. And in fact, there was this really neat moment during the conference where Toby Hemenway, one of my own mentors, was scheduled to give a keynote talk. For a variety of reasons, he wasn't able to do it. They had to find someone at the last minute to talk in his place. And they decided on having a group called Movement Generation, which is based in the Bay Area, speak. And that was really, really powerful for me because Movement Generation is really embodying that idea of the third ethic of people care and redistribution of the surplus by really applying the ethics towards social movements and social change. And they gave a very inspiring talk, mostly in Spanish, because a lot of the organizers there speak Spanish. And of course, being in Cuba, they wanted to be in solidarity with that local language, but talking about lots of the different programs that they're active with in the Bay Area and also on a national scale. Of addressing how does permaculture, what does it mean to communities of color, to working class communities? How can we go out of our way to start addressing the kind of decades and decades of colonial thinking and discrimination, using permaculture as a tool to heal those things and to draw connections between, you know, so many of the movements that social justice advocates have been working tirelessly on for decades and to work with them and show them how their struggles are connected to environmental struggles and to really start to draw those connections. So that was very inspiring to me to see. And there were several other folks in the conference who were speaking along similar lines. So that was also great.
What you just said there speaks to some of the choices that I've made in reaching out to folks to interview on the show, because there are so many other voices that are doing good work that we may never hear of. And I think it was Cody Lundeen, the survival expert, and one of the conversations that he had in an interview, though it also, it may have been Les Stroud. Not that they're two people who are easy to confuse, but I am confusing them in the moment. But one of them were talking about that many of the people who are really the experts in various fields you never hear about because they're just doing their work. And that it's the gurus that we find are the people who are doing their good work who then kind of find an audience in some way. And that it's important to remember all those other people who are doing this that we need to know about because of what they can teach us and their perspectives that are going to be so much different from what we encounter day to day. So I thank you very much for speaking to some of those other experiences that you had.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting that you bring up that point, Scott, because that's something that I've been sitting with a lot recently. Just, I think the difference between truly doing good work as a permaculturalist and whatever that means to you, and being recognized for doing good work, and how those things are certainly not at all the same, and in some cases might be mutually exclusive. You know, I think what can happen in permaculture as well as in any community, any part of society, is that, you know, you get these charismatic spokespeople who get asked more and more to inspire, and they eventually start to become full-time inspirers. And that leaves them very little time to actually do the work that that people find so inspiring. And I think it's important that we all seek to balance the work we do in actually being on the ground and continuing to grow as students, and then sharing that work as teachers, and to not get pulled too far in either direction, and to really seek that balance.
One of my instructors who I'll be spending a weekend with doing some teaching alongside of, it's one of the things that he speaks to is that just because someone teaches doesn't mean that they are truly a teacher. Just because someone wrote a book doesn't mean that they are an expert or know what they're talking about. And that as we move forward as a community, being able to add more voices to the conversation to balance out those perspectives that we sometimes hear the loudest in what we do.
Very much so. And also, I think, to in particular, seek out perspectives from communities that you don't typically see represented, you know, like we were just discussing. So, you know, if all of the charismatic figures are white and male, that's telling you that there is, you know, an imbalance in the system, right? And we all know as permaculturalists that a monoculture is never giving you healthy information. So, yeah, it's great to hear that white male perspective, but what does the perspective of a female person of color have to say about these same issues? And to actively seek that out so we know that we're not missing any crucial things. And obviously, it's not like, you know, every female person of color would have the same perspective on the issues. So, you know, we don't want to tokenize either. But the point is to get as many perspectives from as many different backgrounds as possible.
And that's a conversation that, as we record this, just recently I released an interview with Karen Olson Ramanujan about women in permaculture and a pattern language for women in order to ensure that there is more inclusion in what we're doing. And she presented a 30% solution that once you get, I apologize in the moment, I'm remembering as best as I can, so I'm paraphrasing, any mistakes are my own, that once we get to a 30% participation rate from any underrepresented group, that starts to turn the tide towards more understanding of the broader perspective and the other groups that we are not necessarily including.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good rule of thumb to me, just from my own observations of trying to work in these spaces. And yeah, I think getting to that first 30% takes a lot of extra work. And then once you get there, it starts to, you know, like any regenerative system, it starts to have its own momentum.
Beyond the individuals that you encountered at the IPC in Cuba, what were some of the other highlights that you would speak to from that experience?
Yeah, let's see. Well, you know, as much as I was speaking earlier about the dysfunction of the Cuban economy, one thing that I thought was very inspiring to see was how their food system was a lot less dysfunctional in the absence of the kind of distorted subsidies that we have for industrial agriculture, for commodity farming, right? So, you know, in Cuba, they have a situation where the government owns pretty much all the land. And the government has let a lot of folks use that land for organic farming. And there's not that kind of price competition between organically grown vegetables that take more time and care to raise and vegetables that are grown in the kind of monocrop, pesticide-soaked culture that we have here in the States. And so the relative price difference is very different. So people are willing, it's actually possible to make a decent living in relative Cuban terms growing food. Whereas, you know, unfortunately, that's something that is pretty darn tough in the States. Certainly where I live in Colorado, it's almost impossible. But, you know, there's the government-owned land, and then there's also, of course, the embargo that keeps oil-based products expensive. And so, you know, it really levels that playing field. And so to see what Cubans are doing with that ability to actually make a good living growing food, we saw a lot of worker-owned co-ops, which, you know, when you're talking invisible structures, I find that that's a legal structure that embodies permaculture principles really well. And these co-ops, some of the ones I saw were employing hundreds of people. They were selling to institutions like hospitals and schools. They were providing childcare and of course, healthcare. Cuba is famous for its healthcare. And it was all from growing food and then creating added value products with that food, whether that's medicine or you know, canned food, sauces, things like that, or even compost that, that they would then sell. So, you know, just to see what happens when that playing field is leveled and we don't have to go up against the subsidies of what fossil fuels make artificially cheap and what the farm bill makes artificially cheap, what is possible in just the food production space. So that was really inspiring to me. And then just in terms of content-wise from the conference itself, I was very fascinated to see the dialogue amongst the elders in the movement, what their perspective is and where their consensus is as well as where their disagreements are amongst permaculture as a movement. And where it is and where it's going. There were some very fascinating discussions around standardization of curriculum and how do we make sure that, that PDCs are being taught with integrity without being too heavy-handed about telling people what to teach or how to teach it. Things like that. You know, certainly in the United States, there's a lot of talk right now around creating some kind of or strengthening the existing institutions on a nationwide scale to provide more support for professional development and standardization and things like that. And just hearing some of the back and forth along those lines, all of that I thought was really interesting just to be, you know, kind of an observer, not to really have an opinion one way or the other, but just to understand what are folks talking about who have been in this game for 20, 30 years, what's on their minds.
I'd like to take a moment to explore some of what you were hearing and what some of your thoughts were, because I've been encountering some of the political conversation about standardization, but a lot of my involvement with that and the conversations that I've had are with people who've been excluded from that conversation rather than those who were a part of it.
Sure.
But I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on what you heard rather than try to have words put into someone's mouth or necessarily have you make a judgment on it, but just to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. The first thing I'll say is that it's become pretty clear to me that any kind of conversation around designing institutional structures amongst permaculturalists pretty quickly gets complicated and drawn out because we're all high-level thinkers. We are all really passionate about this stuff. We all have really strong opinions. And despite the fact that we're all permaculturalists, we certainly do not all agree on how this stuff should work. So, you know, as these discussions have been getting going, there's certainly no shortage of strong ideas, and not all of them are always in harmony with one another. But I think everybody's committed to hearing each other's perspective and to, you know, potentially having a polyculture of institutional structures. You know, again, like that kind of healthy competition might be for the best. Just kind of to preface this historically, and of course, with me just being a permaculturist for the last 7-8 years, this is all kind of secondhand information. But from what I've pieced together is when it came time to, you know, get the PDC together back in the 80s, Bill Mollison and his associates were pretty intentional about not structuring too many institutions to oversee how permaculture grew. They very intentionally wanted it to be a self-organizing movement. And for throughout much of the 90s and the early 2000s, that strategy seemed to be very successful. And, you know, it launched these kind of pods of activity throughout the world, throughout the United States, that kind of took permaculture in their own direction, but still with a lot of adherence and integrity to the original kind of Mollisonian take on it. And then what started to happen in the last 5 or 10 years is now it's no longer people who studied under Mollison or his immediate contemporaries that are teaching a lot of permaculture courses. It's people who studied under people who studied under them, right? So I'm 2 or 3 degrees of separation, for example, from Bill Mollison. And so I'm starting to, myself and my contemporaries are starting to take permaculture even farther out from what it was that was originally taught in the PDC. And that can obviously be a great thing and is a much needed thing, but also can present a lot of pitfalls. You know, if folks are taking it in a direction that isn't in line with the ethics or teaching design courses that really aren't adequately covering some core foundational aspects of that 72-hour curriculum and then offering a certificate. So I think what I saw in Cuba was that a lot of the elders are now saying, okay, well, we didn't want it to be a top-down system in the beginning, and we still don't want it to be too much of that kind of thing. But we're at a point in the evolution of permaculture where we might need to at least insert a little bit more of that way of working with this community. Otherwise, permaculture as a movement, it could mean something so entirely different to different people that as a term and as a movement, therefore, it becomes meaningless. And so, you know, there's almost a little bit of backpedaling and trying to figure out, you know, obviously there's, in some ways, the cat's out of the bag. People are going to keep teaching PDCs no matter what with their own perspective. But knowing that, how can we create structures that will provide support and offer opportunities for standardization when people want those? So here in the States, you know, there's a number of different approaches towards doing that. There's the longstanding Permaculture Institute USA. And that's an organization that's been run by Scott Pittman. And Owen Hablutzel is also involved with that. They're based in New Mexico, and they offer diplomas. They have a standard curriculum. And that was essentially the institution that was kind of set up by Bill Mollison here in the States to be the official representation of permaculture in the country. At the same time, there's another organization that is working side by side with that called the Permaculture Institute of North America, or PINA, that's just in its formative stages. There were some kind of great discussions around the development of that institute in Cuba that a number of other elders in the permaculture community have come together to start to create. And they have some documents on their website for folks to look at to understand where they're going. And it seems like they're very open to feedback as well. They very much don't want to be the kind of top-down structure that tells people what to teach or how to teach it, but just to provide one way to plug in on a national scale and to create these kind of bioregional centers and a stronger apprenticeship and diploma program and a number of other things that folks across the country have expressed interest in. So, you know, in Cuba, I observed a bit of back and forth about things like that. I was privy to some initial conversations about North American permaculture convergence, which is now going to be happening. I'm on the kind of core team helping organize that, and that's going to be happening the end of August in Minnesota. And the process of organizing that convergence has been similarly fascinating, of getting feedback from as many people as possible. Obviously, that feedback is all over the board. There's a lot of strong opinions trying to coordinate and condense that feedback into a common vision and planning it. So, you know, it's been a really exciting kind of time for me to be able to listen in and start to participate in these conversations, because I think a lot of the decisions that we make in the next year or two are going to have repercussions for the next generation or two of permaculturalists in the country. And so it's cool to see how those decisions are being made.
Well, thank you, Adam, for sharing that with me. I really appreciate hearing a different perspective on it from what I was coming into our conversation, the place that I was in. in receiving that from you. So thank you.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, you know, my perspective is just one of many. And I think, again, with a community as diffuse as ours, and in some ways intentionally so, it's really hard to get everybody's opinion and incorporate it and create a design that makes everybody happy. But I think what I'm seeing is that at a certain point, you just got to go for it, even if everybody isn't happy at first, and then hope that you can design a structure that's flexible enough that it can respond to everybody's concerns as it goes.
And going back to what you were saying earlier about being, you know, you're two or three generations or two or three connections away from Mollison, in my, you know, lineage in permaculture, if you will, I think I'm six or seven steps removed from that. And when people ask me about, you know, what PDC should I take? What about taking it with this person or that person? It's the question of, well, who did they learn from? Who were their teachers? Who were their students? Do you trust this person as a teacher for whatever reason, yes or no? And, you know, if you're comfortable with them, then that's fine. But if you go in and you have no idea who that person is or where they come from, then maybe there are some questions that need to be asked and some more investigation done before choosing to take a course with someone.
Yeah, I think that's something I'd recommend no matter what, is doing that background research. I think, you know, at this point, the United States permaculture community is still small enough that I think it can work based on reputation. But I think that's starting to become obsolete. You know, I know that there's a ton of really great teachers out there that I don't know what their reputation is. I don't have any firsthand or secondhand knowledge, but I know that they're out there doing great work. And so if someone comes to me asking, is this a good course to take? I can't go on reputation anymore, because there's just too many folks for any one of us to know and understand. There's too much going on. It's outgrown that scale of us being able to know it on a personal level. And so that's why we need other structures to help qualify teachers and help us decide as students, as teachers, who to connect with.
I've been doing this show for going on 4 years this October, and interviewed well over 100 people, contacted probably 500 people to arrange those interviews, and in that process learned all the people who I don't know about. There are names within the community that are only mentions in the foreword of someone's book, or someone says, hey, you should interview this person, and I have no idea who they are, even though they've been doing this for 20 or 30 years.
Right, exactly. And yeah, even if you limit yourself to folks like that who have been doing this forever, there's so many to get to know and learn from and appreciate, not to mention the fact that, of course, this is an exponentially growing movement, and there's probably five times as many people who have been doing this for 5 years and are still doing really, really great work as there are people who have been doing it for 25.
And you and I were not known to each other until we sat down and had conversations.
Exactly. And I would hope that, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of conversations like this happening across the country that we will never know about, and that's okay.
I'll admit that I had a more negative perspective on some of the organizing that's occurring within permaculture right now because of the top-down approach that the message that is coming out from the different organizations is giving. But if those organizations are operating more as a clearinghouse with which to check credentials against and to see, you know, did this person actually take their PDC with this person, and to expand that network, that's more of a warm, fuzzy feeling for me than it is to say, well, this is what you have to teach or not.
Yeah. You know, just on a personal level, and I'm sure many permaculturalists can relate to this, I feel very kind of, what's the word? I don't want people telling me what to teach or what permaculture is and isn't. And while I very much respect Mollison's original 72-hour curriculum, I certainly feel that there's a lot of things that it leaves out that are just as essential, and a lot of things that are in that curriculum that me personally and many of my students would not find relevant in their day-to-day lives. And so I think we all recognize as permaculturalists that the ideal is somewhere in between this spectrum of total anarchy, teach whatever you want and call it permaculture, and the kind of more conventional, at least in our society, top-down system of this is what you must teach that is kind of exemplified by our public education system. I don't think any of us want that other extreme either. And so the question is, where do we find that balance between a kind of self-organizing system and a hierarchical system? And in what very specific ways do we combine the best of those two types of structures?
And that's a dialogue that hopefully the community will have for several years before any kind of fiat decisions are made.
Yeah. And I think even after decisions are made, you know, because at some point, again, decisions just have to be made. But even as decisions are made and started to be implemented, I think that will be an ongoing dialogue. I think mistakes will be made. They will be learned from. And I think this is just something that we're all, again, we're all figuring it out as we go.
From there, are you okay if we move to the Permaculture Voices Conference and your experience there?
Yes. Yeah, sure. That would be great.
As that was not my best segue, would you like to take us from there?
Sure. It was with all of these ideas about kind of permaculture as a movement and these different niches within the international permaculture community in my head that I traveled to San Diego for the Permaculture Voices Conference and saw a very different vision of permaculture being played out there, even more different than a lot of the things I saw in Cuba. I think the intention behind Permaculture Voices was to set up a conference that would make, you know, your kind of suburban corporate worker feel at home and make them as inspired as some kind of lefty hippie who's been living in an eco village. And it was an attempt for permaculture to reach the so-called mainstream. And in a lot of ways, I think it was a very commendable attempt. It was organized like more of a professional conference. It was, like I mentioned, it was at a conference center. It actually happened to be a casino resort, which in itself was a little bit strange for many of us. But the fact was, there were very nice facilities for presenting, and people felt well taken care of. And then, you know, kind of the way the conference was organized was a lot of those kind of big names that people have seen the YouTube videos of and read their books and things like that all in one place. And so I think that was a big draw and really exciting for people. So a lot of those folks giving presentations about kind of where they're at and the work they've been doing. And so it was, you know, very inspiring to folks. And then also several kind of smaller breakout sessions with presentations from other folks teaching about various aspects. I think my take on it in general was that I definitely appreciated the approach of the organizers to make permaculture more accessible and to give it a face that didn't project an air of being so counterculture. I think that's something that a lot of folks have talked about being necessary, but I think we each solve that in different ways. I think it was, for my taste, a little bit overly focused on broad scale and on that kind of classicist definition of permaculture as landscape manipulation on a very large scale, which of course is a very essential part of creating a regenerative society. But as an urban permaculturist who specializes in invisible structures, you know, there were a lot of gaps. I personally actually really enjoyed learning about all that broad scale stuff because that's not my lived experience, but it wasn't that relevant to my day-to-day life either or my teaching practice. So that was one comment. And then, you know, it was also very heavily weighted kind of towards the typical kind of TED Talk style slick presentation, which I think, you know, has its place in a conference like that. But I think, as we were just discussing earlier, I think permaculturalists really appreciate and need a balance between top-down and bottom-up structures. And there wasn't a whole lot of opportunity for kind of networking. And I know that that's something that the conference organizers have recognized and are going to change the next time around. So yeah, those were some of my main thoughts about the conference. But in all, I just thought it was great to see how permaculture is going in a totally different direction. You know, Permaculture Voices was one of many different directions. And that's something that I came away with feeling more and more strongly, is that it's almost cliche to talk about the mainstream and needing to break into the mainstream and things like that. And I actually feel like that's a dangerous way of thinking to fall into. Thinking about the mainstream is thinking about our culture being a monoculture. And even just by believing in that way of thinking, we create it. I try not to think about a mainstream anymore because I don't think anybody would want to be called part of the mainstream. And everybody, even if they live lifestyles that are more common than many of us who are trying to create a different kind of world, each person has a unique set of communities that they're a part of. They have a unique set of circumstances, a unique set of values. And to the extent that there is a mainstream, it's one that's artificially created by mass media and by corporate storefronts that look the same in every place across the country. And that's not something I want to break into. I'm not interested in that. I am interested in reaching every kind of community in this country and making permaculture relevant to them. But that's not going to happen by the lowest common denominator. It needs to happen by reaching each one of those communities one by one on their own terms and through this process of kind of cultural translation. And, you know, I'm a part of this community and that community, and I'm going to take the permaculture that's in this community and share it with that community in a way that they feel comfortable with. And so, you know, to the extent that I think Permaculture Voices was trying to reach the mainstream, that's something that I don't think is a worthy goal. But to the extent that it was trying to reach a specific demographic of kind of more business-minded, perhaps broad-scale oriented folks, I thought it was great.
Speaking to the mainstream of the mainstream, the more that I do what I do, the less that I have a concern about any of that, and that it's about doing what I'm doing to the best level that I can, and that that's what matters. That in the act of doing clears a path, provides a trail, and is an act of leadership for others. Not necessarily that they follow me, but they're given the inspiration to go in their own direction and do their good work. And then through that process, engage those people who are concerned about the message that they have to share, concerned about what it is that they're doing. And that as more models develop and each of us do what it is that we're good at, that more people connect with permaculture in that way, rather than trying to necessarily sell something through our message.
Yeah, I think that's a very healthy approach to it. And certainly one that I share for the most part. I'm not sure that every permaculturalist does share that. And I think some folks have a very kind of intentional goal of marketing permaculture, or of, you know, using the techniques of advertising and branding to bring permaculture to an audience that it wouldn't otherwise. And to a certain extent, I'm sure that will be successful and in reaching more people that whose lives will later be transformed by permaculture. But, you know, for reasons I was talking about earlier, I definitely think there's limitations to that approach. You know, when you go for quantity, you sacrifice quality. And if there's anything that I think sets permaculture apart from so many other environmental and other movements, it's that integrity, it's that quality, it's that grounding in the ethics, it's that thoroughness. I think that's something that, you know, over the next few years, as we see different people trying to scale permaculture in different ways, I think we're going to see more and more examples of that quality being lost. And again, I think this is just part of the process. I think it's just something that we'll go through and observe and continue to dialogue about as a movement. And if we're really open to feedback and learning from our examples, then we'll adapt.
I don't think that there's any risk of the good work that permaculture practitioners are doing going away, but the way that the message is delivered or received may vary over time, but that's something that we can work on and respond with as it occurs.
Right, exactly. I mean, I know right now there's also a lot of debate about online PDCs, right? And of course, you're teaching an online PDC, and I'm sure you're approaching it with as much integrity as you can and trying to deliver the fullest experience to students that you can. But there's some people that would say, and I don't have an opinion on this either way, but there's some people that think any kind of online PDC period is a sacrilege. You know, it's like you can never fully learn permaculture online. So I think these are great conversations to be having. And I think we should try all of these methods and continue talking about them and have respect for those of us that have a different approach than we do. And really, because I think we're all in this for the same reasons, and we all want to see what's effective. And so I think only time will tell, but in the meantime, let's experiment and debate.
And it's that kind of feedback that had me re-examine what it is that I was doing in that environment and learn from it and change the program really in the middle of the experience for my students in order to make it more in line with what it was that I wanted to present and do. That quality that you speak of, I think, is a big concern. I know that for me, with some of the pieces that you mentioned about, you know, quality and what Mollison gave us in something like the Designer's Manual as a PDC curriculum, It's more than enough, yet not enough at the same time. And what is appropriate? And I found that the PDC experience for me as an individual going through it, and then as an educator, as I learn more from graduate studies about environmental education, as I look at another step at a PhD in education for myself, that the PDC to me as a teacher isn't enough. It just isn't. And that there needs to be more to it so that students, when they are done, are completely prepared for whatever it is they want to do when they're done. But again, that's only my perspective and my place. I know there are plenty of students who wouldn't want to take a long PDC that is within my format or what I'm trying to accomplish. So there are other opportunities that are available. In a lot of these conversations, the understanding occurs in the dialogue. If we're not talking about it, we can't understand why people are making these choices. And that's where, as a community, we talk about it and we understand and learn from it and find the place of what does and doesn't work and what is and isn't appropriate.
Yeah. I think we all have to keep an open mind and, on the one hand, be open to change, you know, be open to ways of doing things that we didn't think were possible before, and be open to be proven wrong and to admit that our previous opinions were wrong. I think that's a really humbling and important quality to have. And on the other hand, to maintain our own integrity and to speak up for what we feel is appropriate. You know, just another thread that's been going through my mind as we've been talking about this is I'm feeling more and more that the PDC as a method of instruction or as a way of introducing permaculture to people is trying to be everything to everyone. We found ourselves in the permaculture movement in this kind of educational monoculture of methods. You know, if you want to learn permaculture, you have to take this PDC, and there's a number of different ways to take it, but you're going to learn these same things more or less. And it's going to take approximately, you know, between 72 and 100 or something hours. And I hear over and over again that that's just less and less effective as we're trying to reach different kinds of people. And I don't know if this is going to happen anytime soon, because, again, it takes some of these larger scale structures to allow us to coordinate and have these discussions. And, of course, there's lots of people that feel that the PDC is just fine and shouldn't be changed. But I kind of feel personally that we need a whole array of introductions to permaculture, intensive introductions to permaculture of various lengths. And some need to be short and some need to be longer. And they each need to have a kind of curriculum that's somewhat standardized and somewhat flexible so that we don't feel like we have to cram everybody into this box of a permaculture design course. I think the essential ethics, principles, design process, ecological literacy, all of those things are fundamental to permaculture and should be taught in any permaculture course. But from there, as you've had countless conversations about, I'm sure, you can take things in so many directions. And so why limit ourselves to this two-week curriculum? Well, it's because what we've always done, and it's because this is what the founder told us to do. And those are some good reasons and shouldn't be taken lightly, but they're worth questioning as well.
We've gone over and reviewed a ton of different pieces of the permaculture puzzle in this conversation. Is there anything else that you would like to add to the conversation for the listeners? I think that I've kind of run the course in our time together and need to chew over some of the things that we've discussed before I would have more follow-up to it.
I think I feel like we covered a lot of ground, and I feel like I said everything I wanted to say about Cuba and the Voices Conference and permaculture as a movement. I think it was great to share some of those thoughts and to bounce them off of you.
And I thank you for sharing all that with us. I didn't make it to either. I've got another 2 or 3 years until I travel heavily, so I really appreciate getting to hear what else is going on in the world. Thank you again, Adam, for joining me for the conversation.
Yeah, my pleasure, Scott. Look forward to doing it again sometime.
And that was Adam Brock. In addition to his work at the Grow House and at peoplepattern.org, he is also a past guest of the show, and I've included a link to those earlier conversations in the show notes, as well as to the people and resources he mentioned. After speaking with Adam, I'm excited for where permaculture is currently and where it is going, though I was initially hesitant about some of the organizing that's occurring and some of the things that I've heard about it being a bit exclusionary of some people. At the moment, there's still room under this incredible umbrella of design that we can shake things up, experiment, try new things, and see what happens. Together, we can continue this journey into the future and find out what it holds. Finally, Jen Mendez at permikids.com has another Edge Alliance coming up on Saturday, August 3rd, 2014. Helen, from One Hen, will present on how to help children develop personal responsibility and connect with community by examining three questions. How can personal responsibility relate to social entrepreneurship? What can it look like for children? What soft and hard skills that must be present for kids to self-empower and community empower in this way? You can find out more about Jen's work at permikids.com. If you'd like to share your thoughts or visions of a permaculture future, or have your class featured in a show announcement, please let me know. Call 717-827-6266, email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, get in touch via Skype, Permaculture Podcast, or like the show at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or follow along with me on Twitter where I am @permaculturecst. Until the next time, spend each day creating a better world by taking care of the earth, yourself, and each other.